Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. As medical care and technology have progressed, we have culturally separated ourselves from natural processes like death and dying, which have taken on a stigma of otherness and medical failure, though they are in fact part of all of us. Tulsa is lucky to have many esteemed educators and practitioners in palliative care and hospice medicine, practices which provide comfort and care to those among us that are suffering, whether at end of life or at any time in a continuum of illness. One of our local providers, Hospice of Green Country, is holding an event with a superstar in the field here tomorrow night, which will take place at the Philbrook Museum. The event will include the screening of an Academy Award-nominated documentary called Endgame that features my guest today, Dr. B.J. Miller, a hospice and palliative care physician at the University of California at San Francisco. B.J. Miller's TED Talk titled What Really Matters in the End has been viewed more than 9 million times. Miller was featured in a January 2017 story in the New York Times Magazine called One Man's Quest to Change the Way We Die. At that time, Miller was director of a unique facility in San Francisco called the Zen Hospice Project. Miller, along with co-author Shoshana Berger, has a new book called A Beginner's Guide to the End, which is just out from Simon & Schuster. It's a gorgeous book which aims to demystify death and dying and bring it back into its natural context and make us all less afraid and able to confront death on our own terms. B.J. Miller, co-author of A Beginner's Guide to the End, who will be appearing tomorrow at the Philbrook Museum, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. B.J. Miller, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start just by asking you about the book, A Beginner's Guide to the End. Tell us about the beginning of this project. Now, you've been doing work in hospice and palliative care medicine and then had a very successful TED Talk. And there's a little bit on it in the book itself, but I'm wondering how you and your co-author, Shoshana Berger, who is not in the medical field, got together to put together this guide.
Yeah, I mean, do you know the design firm IDEO, John? Have you ever heard of IDEO, I-D-E-O?
I had heard of it loosely, and I had I certainly have learned more about it now in light of doing a little bit of research after having read the book.
Yeah, so they're a very big design firm, and they've done all sorts of cool stuff in the world. And I don't know what exactly how it came to be, but I ended up in their offices one day to talk about shoes for prosthetic feet. So, from your research, I'm an amputee and use prosthetic legs, and had this other idea, not in my day job world, about design for prostheses. And anyway, ended up meeting these guys at IDEO and talking to them about this particular idea. And we got to talking about aesthetics, one of my favorite subjects, and what I think of as sort of the underdeveloped therapeutic potential of the aesthetic world. And that led to bigger conversations with folks there. And then that led to discussion about my day job and on it went in a sort of mysterious way. We just became professional buddies. And eventually, at that time, I was working at Zen Hospice Project. And we finally ended up hiring IDEO to help us with sort of retooling the aesthetic of the website and of our organization. And in that process, I met Shoshana Berger, who is their editorial director. And by virtue of working on the project, IDEO, like a lot of design firms, works in sort of an immersive way, sort of ethnography. They really sort of try to sink into the subject and look at it from a zillion angles. So we had all sorts of interesting conversations, and it came out that she had recently lost her father. And we were digging deeper on the subject of end of life. And eventually she said, we should write a book, because you may feel this, John, when you talk about certain aspects of medicine, especially at least for me in end of life, where you can watch sort of the public wake up to the idea that, A, oh, we die. B, healthcare doesn't do such a great job. C, holy cow, we got to do something. So I don't know if you see that, but that process comes up. And Shoshana simply said, we really got to work on a book on this. The world could use a book. No one knows exactly how to handle this. So I pretty quickly said yes, because I knew the world could use a book trying to do what we were doing, and had thought about it before, but was never, ever tempted, because I'm not really a writer, or I'm not a writer, period. But also every other time I'd ever thought about it, it ended up thinking about it with other clinicians, and I didn't think the world needed another clinical. I mean, the world needed something that was geared towards us all as people, as the public. So it felt really, really good to have Shoshana as a partner, as a non-clinician, to help, if anything, sort of demedicalize the subject. Plus, she was a journalist by training, and we knew each other by now, and so it just felt like a good fit, and away we went.
I would say you're have been very successful in demedicalizing the book. Remind us, Shoshana, you said, was caring for her father, who had he had dementia, I believe, and so she had to be, I don't know if it was primary caregiver or along with other family members, care for her father for a number of years. Is that right?
That is right. Stanley Berger, had a form of dementia, and I think it was about 5 years from the time of diagnosis to the time of his death. And that cast Shoshana and her sister Maya, and mother and stepmother to varying degrees, into the caregiving roles. And so that experience had deeply informed Shoshana's take on this whole subject.
Now, when you, it's interesting because in your now pretty famous TED Talk and the fact that you just discussed IDEO, I mean, it's clear to me that you, and you already mentioned, you think about aesthetics. So one question I have for you is, do you consider yourself a designer as much as a doctor?
No, I wouldn't say that. I'm only out of respect for the design trade, design thinker. Yes, this design lens, as I find it, it'd be a very useful lens to see the world, especially the material world and the world of process. So design thinking actually is something, I wouldn't call it a science, but it'd be a quasi-science, a social science. It's essentially an ethnographic way of seeing the world that you're trying to work with someone other than yourself, that you need to, you need to immerse yourself in that person's experience or that group's experience somehow. You need to, that, in other words, that empathy is the ground. And then secondly, you often find yourself working inductively. So you start with the user experience in the design world, or for us in medicine, we start with the patient and family experience. And then in some ways, you inductively work backwards from there. You say, it comes up with the end of life all the time, sort of like imagine the end that we're heading for. And then you work upstream to kind of fill in the blanks to get you there. So that sort of inductive reasoning admixed with this base in empathy makes me very attracted to design thinking. And I see a huge overlap between design thinking and the palliative care mindset. And I'm also very keen to see palliative care as larger than just medicine. So sort of if our subject matter really is quality of life, suffering, essentially the human condition. Well, it's great that in palliative medicine we have, docs, nurses, social workers, chaplains, aides, volunteers, et cetera. I mean, that's a beautifully round, big table in the world of medicine. But again, if your subject is suffering and human condition and mortality, well, no one discipline has a lock on that, and just about any discipline could find itself relevant to that big conversation. So I was very excited to professionally to expand the purview of who was invited to this conversation. But yes, back to your question, John, no, I am moved by design. I am moved by how things feel and smell and look in the world of the senses. That is a main driver for me in my life. That's true.
But listeners who don't know your personal story, when you were in college, suffered an electrocution accident and a near-death experience and wound up in the burn unit at a hospital in New Jersey, subsequently losing both legs below the knee as well as your left arm below the elbow.
Yeah.
So you're a triple amputee. One question that, and you're very open about all this and have lived your life very unapologetically and learned to, live with these differences. And do your other senses, I mean, when you talk about, visual, I mean, and you, I do know, too, that you were an art history major as an undergraduate.
Yeah.
So do you feel like your personal health history and trauma has heightened your other senses?
Well, I don't know my other senses per se, but they've certainly ramped up my interest in my other senses. I would say my interest in my body. I think, like some of us, it's very easy, if not impossible, not to take your body for granted, especially when you're quote-unquote healthy. Most of us probably don't take time to think of ourselves in any way besides our body. you know, our physiology sort of dominates, healthcare dominates as a sort of as a physiological, physical view on the world. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I think most of us, I used to take my body for granted. And then losing parts of my body, dealing with those little partial deaths, that had many effects, including just made me acutely, deeply aware of my body, aware of what a fragile thing it was, also aware of what a remarkable thing it was. And it just got me, the accident brought me down to thinking about life at the level of sort of raw material. And so it absolutely did ramp up my senses. But I guess the more accurate way of saying it is it ramped up my interest in my senses.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is BJ Miller, who is a hospice and palliative care physician at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also the co-author of a new book called A Beginner's Guide to the End, along with Shoshana Berger, who is an editor at the design firm IDEO, I-D-E-O. One of the things, when I was asking about design, I was really curious because this book, although it, I guess when you first glance at it, it appears like a very welcoming but somewhat heavy tome, almost 2 pounds. When you open it up, it's just a stunningly gorgeous book. First of all, the print, I think, is probably larger than standard, which was very welcome to me. And there's a lot of drawings in the book that are just very, I have to say, they're just comforting. They make you feel like, you know, just welcome in a way. And I guess, how conscious was this? I mean, I imagine that you were working with a design firm, but not to put like a quantity on it, but you know, how much of this reflects you or Shoshana, your co-author, or the publishing team, or just the kind of the fermentation that occurred with all of the folks involved?
I was just saying how grateful I am for that comment, John. That is, you just described so much of the effect that we had hoped for. The design prompt, when we were thinking through how the book would look and feel, we went to the publisher's design team and we hired folks ourselves on the side to help. And the design cue was that the book needs to feel palliative. Like, it needs to feel good to hold it, to open it, to look at it. Like, it needs to be its own message. And that message is one of palliation, you know, of feeling better. So that was very much on purpose. And then we hired, we worked with an illustrator by the name of Marina Luz, L-U-Z. And she just did beautiful work, as you commented. She's the one who did all the drawings. We gave her prompts, but she really ran with it. I mean, one of the prompts was, obviously we wanted sketches because, you know, photographs or anything too realistic, well, then it becomes too tempting for people to project themselves only on things that looks like them. And something that's too realistic could be hazardous and actually alienate viewers or readers. So it was important that we have sketches, sort of rudimentary, basic sketches, onto which just about anyone could see themselves. That was important. And actually, one of our hero books to Marina to look through and as inspiration was, I don't know if you'll remember this book, John, but it was, I saw it in my dad's sock drawer, which is... a book called The Joy of Sex.
Yes. I remember a copy on my parents' shelf as well.
Yep. Well, so there you go. I mean, it was, you know, in a way, I don't want to make too much of this, but, you know, that book did what, in some way, what we hope this book will do for the taboo of dying. That book did for the taboo of sex. Again, I don't want to make too much of that, but the inspiration there was the sketches, the drawings in that book were so sort of basic and rudimentary, like we're saying, that you could see yourself in them and they would age well. So that was very, very much deliberate. And then finally, yes, the print was a huge, the publisher, we were so grateful to the publisher for saying yes to that. They agreed with this. They wanted to make it easy to read and make it accessible. And that meant more pages that they'd have to print to have the larger text, but it felt very much worth it. So it was a big team effort.
Well, it's just so interesting because I could imagine the concept of saying, hey, we want the book itself to be palliative or feel comforting. And yet, you know, there's literally millions, hundreds of millions, billions of books out there. And it's like, you know, reinventing the wheel is not easy. But I don't know, somehow I feel like you really accomplished it. It's really impressive because it's just a book that really does welcome you in. I mean, there's just no other way to say it.
Thanks, bud. That's great. And I will just simply say, as you can imagine, with this subject, as much trepidation and fear as the subject matter might crime in people. It felt not only interesting to try to do that that way, John, but essential. Like, how are we going to get people to actually open a book with this title? And so that was one way we thought we could help make that happen. So anyway, thank you for noticing.
Well, and I wanted to ask too, because it's so interesting that you, both personally and then professionally, deal a lot with death, you know, quite frankly. And then Shoshana, mm-hmm. as a caregiver for her aging and a father who had dementia, both bring your own experiences to this book, which are quite profound. And then, one of the sort of guides to the reader in this is we use the I interchangeably. And actually, it's quite easy, I think. You speak with this unified voice, and when sometimes you're hearing I, and I was caring for my father. Sometimes you're hearing I, you know, was caring for a patient, and it's pretty clear which author is speaking. But I do wonder. There was clearly a lot of research done for the book as well. What was the balance between being able to write about, because there's so many topics in here, right? And you write about the clinical, both in terms of, you know, what it's like to have symptoms, you know, so there is a medical aspect to it, but there's so much that's arguably social or psychological. You know, what about the paperwork and what about the grieving? I mean, how did you tackle that?
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, the outline came relatively easily because it really was just, thankfully, Shoshana and I both could simply reference our own lives. Like, gosh, you know, it was particularly easy for Shoshana, who was fresh on the heels. When we started working this book, Shoshana was still only measured in months since her father had died. So she had the memory of all the things, all the information she wished she had known. And then I had the information from clinic that I, you know, watched and worked with patients through all the time. So it was actually pretty easy to flesh out the landscape of subject matter that a comprehensive book might include. So the outline, and then seeing all that subject matter, and you're right, you're so right. And it's a really key point of it. It's like, yes, there's some medical piece in here. We're not anti-medical. I love medicine. I just think medicine needs to be kept in its place. And there are some issues that are larger than medicine, and dying is certainly one of them. No one gets to be the boss of this subject, but medicine's a huge piece of it, just not the whole thing. So the content became pretty easy to flesh out. And then it was a matter of sort of how do we lay it out in the book? And that we chose a sort of a rough chronology. Like, the book begins with the things that anyone might do at any point in their life, you know, advanced care planning, thinking about their mortality, et cetera. Like that, you know, our point would be that should begin early in life, as part of the sort of normal daily life. And then the second half of the book really enters with someone who's just gotten a diagnosis. So that's where all this abstraction starts becoming real for a person. The middle of the book is really dealing with getting a diagnosis and dealing with it. And then the last third of the book is really about the death itself and what comes next, namely grief and then all the nitty-gritty little things that a family needs to tend to for funerals and memorials, et cetera. So that was the process. You sort of lay out all the things we wish could be in one place, tie the subject matter together so that we didn't make our readers get all this information piecemeal in the world. Make the point that this is interdisciplinary work just by including content that spans sectors and disciplines. And then we sort of hit on that structure that I mentioned. And I feel like, all things considered, trying to boil the ocean with a subject like this, it feels like we got to a pretty decent place. Lord knows we'll be finding things that should have been in this book for eons, and we'll find things that probably didn't need to be in this book for eons too. So hopefully we'll get to a second edition where we can clean it up based on how it feels in the public.
And BJ, you alluded earlier to the Zen Hospice of San Francisco. I was wondering if you could share with our listeners a little bit about the story of Zen Hospice. And you, at one point, were the, I guess, executive director or medical director there, but are no longer. But can you tell us about that?
Gladly. So the Zen Hospice Project, it was a very interesting organization that started in San Francisco, grew out of the San Francisco Zen Center in, I believe it was 1987. And it cut its teeth. It grew out of, you know, in 1987 in San Francisco, the AIDS crisis was in full bloom. And many religious organizations found themselves as a sanctuary for people who are kicked out of their homes or otherwise isolated. It was a real, you know, at that time, medicine was falling on its face in its response to the crisis in a lot of ways. Public policy was very divisive. It was a hard time. And so the Zen Center was aware of this and said, gosh, well, we have this building across the street, this old Victorian, and I can't remember what they had been using it for, but they repurposed that building and turned it into a little hospice house in an effort to kind of lean into and support the public's pain. So that was the late 80s. And, you know, the organization kind of did all sorts of interesting things. A very small place, it was 6 beds. But they developed a volunteer training program to help train people essentially to be volunteers and essentially do the work of an aide to accompany people who are dying. And the organization did great, beautiful things for years. And then in 2004, I believe it was, they had been doing a lot of that stuff under the radar, as a lot of nonprofits had been in the 80s. And there was just so much important work that needed to be doing. I don't think anyone was looking very carefully. But late, early 2000s, that caught up with the organization. They had to close their doors, go get a license, bring the building up to code, and do all that kind of work. And that took 7 years. And frankly, the board wasn't clear if it wanted to reopen the house. Running the house was a labor of love, but a really difficult labor at that. And some folks felt that the organization was better served really focusing its work on training volunteers. Anyway, they decided to reopen their doors in 2011, and that's when I joined the organization. I had been very interested in, I had heard about them. I was very interested in the idea of approaching the end of life, like I mentioned earlier, in a non-medical way. And so to have a place that was functioning as from a sort of a spiritual or humanistic plane seemed very, very interesting to me. And plus, I still am very interested in architecture and the environment of care and what that does to the experience. And so here, this little organization that's beautiful old Victorian, and I was very attracted to that too. So anyway, I jumped from full-time academic medical work to part-time medical work and then took on this job as executive director at Zen Hospice Project, where I worked for 5 years. So I left there in 2016.
And it seemed like such an ideal fit for you in the kinds of things that, at least in the stuff I've read about you or, you know, heard on a TED Talk that you care about. But so ultimately you decided to leave the executive director position, but share with us what your thinking was.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about the organization internally and externally. It's a remarkable place, and it was a complicated place. And I had 5 years trying to be a boss and trying to be an administrator. I learned a ton. It was such good education for me. I wish every clinician had some part-time gig at some point trying to administer healthcare. It's really hard, and the systems issues are profound. So I felt like, on the one hand, I had tried everything that I knew to try, and I had learned as much as I was going to learn from that particular post. And for me, the world of patient care was calling. I found it very frustrating as executive director. I couldn't really tend to the people in the bed nearly so much as I was delegating to others to do so. And again, that was important. But eventually, I found myself really missing the thing that I was trained to do, which was to, you know, work with individuals, patients, and family. But then, in this sort of weird turn of events, right on the same time, the TED Talk you referenced, John, came out. And the TED Talk came into being, that's another thing. That actually came through IDEO. Someone, the designer I mentioned earlier, the guy I was talking with about aesthetics and the therapeutic value of aesthetics, he surreptitiously nominated me for this thing called the TEDx Prize, which I didn't know anything about. I barely knew anything about TED, but one day I get a call basically from the TED guy saying, well, you didn't get this prize that I didn't know anything about. You didn't get this prize, but as a consolation, would you like to give a TED talk? And at that time, I was fully, you know, most of my job as executive director running the Hospice Project was essentially raising money. I mean, that place was not covered by insurance, and that was the job. The bulk of the job was trying to bring in financial support to the organization. So the idea, the opportunity to give a TED talk on a big stage like that to draw attention to the subject and to the hospice was not something we could pass up. So that's how the TED talk came to be. But as this was all playing out, the TED talk hit the world, and the world actually kind of paid attention to it in ways that I didn't see coming. And I'd always been interested in sort of the public face, the public interface between healthcare and the public it's trying to serve, and knew that to be a pretty fraught zone. So I was going to head back to more full-time clinical work, but at that time, the public, there seemed to be a window cracking open on this subject where this old trope that we Americans are in denial and no one wants to think about death and talk about death. I mean, to some degree, that's very true, but it's not totally true. And my experience, like especially with the TED Talk, was this experience of seeing that people were really thirsty and hungry to talk about this. They just didn't know how or where to do so. It's a hard subject to bring up without scaring people, et cetera. So I sort of got the sense that the public was really ready to lean into this subject. And I was certainly deeply aware that my field of palliative care needed more attention brought to it, that there were policy issues that were necessary, that were workforce issues that needed beefing up. So for all sorts of reasons, it seemed valuable to be leaning into the public space. And so I put the sort of clinical urge on hold a little while longer, and that's when I decided to work on the book, and that's when I took on a lot more public speaking engagements. I still do my clinic one day a week, but it remains in this sort of this small part of what I do. And so that's sort of the arc from getting to Zen Hospice through Zen Hospice and shooting out of the place. I will say one more thing, John, in case it's interesting to your readers, because I think there are a lot of stories here of importance. Zen Hospice had to close again, maybe a year or two after I left. And it wasn't because I left. It didn't close because I wasn't there. That is not the narrative. It closed because it was just too hard to keep getting the financial support to keep the lights on and do the good work of the hospice house. So they took on some debt to try to make it work and try new things. And ultimately, they had to close the doors again. So I mentioned that to kind of complete the story, but also as a cautionary tale. I mean, this is, I think our listeners, we in society have to think about what do we want in our communities. And a hospice house like that, I think, is a treasure within a community. We have to figure out how to build these places and support these places. So I think there's a caution here for all of us. Like, yes, this subject affects everybody, but we as a society haven't fully really reckoned with it yet. And there's going to be a volume of people needing care as our population ages. And we really have to think about where do we want, where are our priorities? And I would encourage any community to think about how they're tending to their elders and the folks who are dying as a really important piece of their civic fabric. And it's very hard to do that. There are not supports necessarily to do that. We have to make these up. We have to innovate around this subject.
Well, the name of the book is A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. It's by my guest today, B.J. Miller, and his co-author, Shoshana Berger. B.J. Miller is a hospice and palliative care physician at UCSF, the University of California, San Francisco, and he'll be appearing here in Tulsa Tuesday, October 22nd at the Philbrook Museum from 5 to 8 p.m., where a Netflix documentary will be aired, and he will be speaking. And that event is free and open to the public, and you can find out more information by going to hospiceofgreencountry.org. B.J. Miller, thank you so much for speaking. I was really looking forward to your visit here.
Thank you, John. It's a real pleasure, man. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.